Governor Sean Parnell announces his plans for 2014. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski hears subsistence concerns in Glen Allen.
Really focused to a great degree on access to game, access to areas, to harvest game.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Energy Authority encourages you to renovate right this spring. Alaskans spend up to 50% of their income on energy. For energy-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority. Alaskan educators can earn a master's degree in educational leadership, special education, and more from the University of Alaska Southeast. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Southeast.
For months, there has been speculation as to whether Governor Sean Parnell would run for re-election or choose to go up against Democrat Mark Begich in the Senate race. Tonight, he made his announcement in Fairbanks at a meeting of the Republican women. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez is with us to talk about his decision. Hello, Alexandra.
Hi, Lori.
So the big question, what's Parnell running for?
Well, he announced that he's going to be running for re-election as governor. As an incumbent, it would be pretty hard for Democrats to beat him. Public policy polling did a survey back in January, and the strongest Democratic contender that they asked about came out 9 points behind him. That was Ethan Berkowitz. There are a few factors, though, that could make this race interesting. Passing a bill to cut oil taxes this session was Parnell's biggest political win so far, but at the same time, a referendum to repeal that very legislation could be on the same ballot with him.
Alexandra, is there any reason why this announcement is happening in Fairbanks?
The interior scene is a critical area politically. It's hard to win a state race without winning Fairbanks. And right now, Parnell has some goodwill built up there. He made it one of his priorities this past legislative session to get a natural gas trucking plan through, which would bring cheaper energy costs to interior residents. Energy relief has been a big ask for them for a while, and now under Parnell's administration, they're finally getting it.
Thanks so much, Alexandra.
My pleasure, Lori.
APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez giving us that update from Juneau. Over the past few months, states like Kansas and North Dakota have moved so-called fetal personhood measures forward as a challenge to Roe v. Wade. Today, Alaska's Supreme Court reaffirmed that such anti-abortion laws would not hold up in this state. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports.
In 2010, Clinton Desjarlais spearheaded an initiative stating that the right to life starts at conception, outlawing abortion in almost every situation. It never made it to the ballot. Before Desjarlais could even start collecting signatures for his initiative, the Department of Law concluded that such legislation would be clearly unconstitutional. Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell decided not to certify the measure. The issue of fetal personhood has long been important to Desjarlais. He campaigned on it as a fringe candidate in two state races. So Desjarlais took his case to the courts. After the Superior Court ruled against him, the Supreme Court heard his argument. Desjarlais represented himself and made references to, quote, the United States Constitution, the Bible, the Declaration of Independence, maxims of law, the Nuremberg trials, various Alaska statutes and rules of procedure, and various dictionaries to make his case that abortion should be illegal in nearly every circumstance, including rape. He also requested a jury, demanded that the state's attorneys show their law licenses, and asked for the judges to give proof that they had taken an oath of office. The Supreme Court was not persuaded by Desjarlais' arguments. They unanimously ruled that such a sweeping anti-abortion measure would violate not just Roe v. Wade, but the state's own constitution. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
A former aide to Senator Lisa Murkowski, who served time in prison for falsifying his fishing records, is now working as a lobbyist. Records from the first quarter of this year show Arnie Fugelvog represented four commercial fishing companies. The Kodiak Daily Mirror reports that Fugelvog is listed as president of Coastal Resource Strategies, LLC, a lobbying firm based in Seattle. The story was first reported by the website Open Secrets. In 2011, Fugelvog pleaded guilty to falsifying commercial fishing records for profit. He resigned as an aide to Murkowski shortly before his plea deal with prosecutors was made public. He was sentenced to 5 months in prison. According to federal records, he registered as a lobbyist on February 1st of this year. Senator Lisa Murkowski held a listening session on subsistence in Glen Allen yesterday. The meeting followed a similar meeting in Bethel last month. Murkowski says the issues raised in Glen Allen were different from those voiced in Bethel.
Really focused to a great degree on access to game, access to areas to harvest game. I heard very, very clearly concerns about trespass on native lands. I heard very, very clearly the complications that present themselves with a dual management system between the federal system and the state system and how complicated it then becomes.
Senator Murkowski says that's different than in Bethel, where comments were targeted on chronically weak king salmon returns to the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers. She says most of the comments in Glen Allen were from Otna area native people, and there was some concern about competition for resources.
As we see more and more hunters coming from the urban centers to come out into the Otna region, the pressure on the game and the availability of the moose, of the caribou, how then the native people who again live in that area, whose lands are there, feel that there has been increased hunting pressure that has made access to game more difficult.
Murkowski says local residents said the situation is complicated by a puzzle of state and federal jurisdiction. The listening sessions on subsistence were committed to by Senator Murkowski during the Alaska Federation of Natives convention last fall. The senator says the next step is to take what she heard in Bethel and Glen Allen back to a Senate committee for a formal hearing at the end of the summer. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a bacon lover's dream.
This cottage bacon will taste somewhere in between bacon, ham, and pork chops. And it'll cook white, just like a regular piece of pork would.
Yum. That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
For several months in 2009, Redoubt Volcano had residents of South Central Alaska on edge. Scientists warned that the volcano could erupt at any time in January, but it wasn't until mid-March that Redoubt sent an ash plume thousands of feet into the air. And seismologist Diana Roman with the Carnegie Institution wanted to understand more about the unusual pattern leading up to the eruption. She says usually, right before a volcano erupts, there is a short period of something called seismic tremor. But in the case of the Redoubt eruption, it went on for months.
So that was something unusual that I was interested in trying to understand. You know, why had this volcano essentially broken the pattern, the typical pattern of pre-eruption seismicity?
And what did you learn?
Our interpretation of what we observed in our analysis is that several months before the eruption, magma started ascending beneath the volcano. But it did so very slowly, and probably wasn't a whole lot of magma that first started coming up. And we think that there was enough magma that did make it shallow enough that it was able to generate this tremor signal. But it wasn't enough magma, and it wasn't traveling quickly enough to generate the types of earthquakes that we normally see several months out prior to an eruption. Then immediately before the eruption, what we observe in our analysis of the seismic data is evidence that the rate of ascent or the rate of pressurization of the magma increased very quickly. So within about 48 hours before the eruption, we started to see evidence that there was shallow magma that was pressurizing, and this, of course, culminated in the eruption that happened in March of 2009.
Was it a total anomaly, or has Readout acted similarly in the past?
Readout erupted in 1989 as well, and I'm sure many listeners remember that was a somewhat famous eruption because of an incident with an aircraft. And that eruption also was preceded by somewhat anomalous seismicity. There were very short warnings only from the seismic signals before that eruption. So Readout is kind of an interesting volcano to look at and try and think about why it behaves the way it does and how can we understand the signals, the warnings that it does give before it erupts.
How could this help in forecasting Readout activity in the future?
Well, of course, our hope is that the types of things that we learn from these retrospective studies will in the future be able to be incorporated into sort of routine volcano monitoring activities and forecasting activities. Our analysis showed that there was a very short-term change that occurred in the seismicity below the volcano about 48 hours before the eruption started. And so that's a very exciting thing from a forecasting perspective, because finding something that changes at the very last minute that potentially tells you, okay, the volcano is just about ready to go, is really great to be able to make a very, very short-term forecast and say, okay, now we really need to take precautions and be aware that an eruption is imminent.
Diana Roman is a staff scientist seismologist at the Carnegie Institution. People have been arriving in Wrangell for this weekend's rededication of the Chief Shakes Island House. KSTK's Shady Grove Oliver has this story on the canoes that came for the event.
Dry land and friendly faces were a welcome sight for the paddlers after a long and hard journey to Wrangell. The Wrangell canoe headed to Bank Island Wednesday morning to meet the other crews. At Five Mile Island, Wrangell's crew needed to board their support boat due to dangerously rough seas. Paddlers from Kasan and Thorn Bay were already on the island when the Wrangell crew arrived. A teenage paddler from Prince of Wales became separated from the rest of his crew while on a hike in the early afternoon. Wrangell Search and Rescue responded to the crew's call in the early evening. The paddler was found safe and unhurt about 2 hours later, but he was missing for over 5 hours. The rest of the paddlers from Juneau, Sitka, Yakutat, Petersburg, and Prince of Wales arrived just before midnight. They warmed up by a large fire pit in the main bunkhouse on the island and tried to dry out many layers of wet clothing. The seven canoes left Bank Island at about noon yesterday to finish the journey to Wrangell. After a brief stop at Five Mile, the canoes lined up and paddled through the breakwater. Each canoe requested permission to land on Shakes Island.
Land your canoe here!
Wrangell elders welcomed each individually and gave them fresh water. Reporting in Wrangell, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Tuesday was the last day of operation for the Bill Brady Healing Center. The inpatient drug and alcohol rehab program has existed in its current form since 1996. Its closure is blamed on federal budget cutbacks. The center is part of the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium, or SEARCH, which relies heavily on federal money. KCAW's Ed Ronco visited their offices as they packed up their desks and looked back at their time working for the center.
In the lobby of SEARCH's Community Health Building, Doug Osborne leads me over to a red and black blanket hanging on the wall.
So this blanket right here, at the end of the courses, they graduate people, maybe 10, 12 people at the end of this 40-day program. They do a really great job of honoring people, and they do a cradling ceremony, and sometimes they are wrapped in the blanket, so they really know how to send people off. And today it's about how well we can send them off.
Osborne's job at SEARCH includes running the Employee Recognition Program, and today he's planning a farewell luncheon for the 23 people who work at Bill Brady Healing Center.
These guys were superstars. I mean, they're really good, they're passionate, ethical, dedicated. They worked hard and did a good job. So it's a very sad day at Search to see these guys go.
We are walking down a street on the Search campus.
So their treatment house is over here, and then this is the offices.
Okay.
And so we'll just go and see who's here.
Inside is George House. The bookshelves in his office are almost bare, as is his desk.
Actually, I've been working at Bill Brady for 10 years now. I started out as a temporary night awake to earn a couple of bucks and liked what I saw.
As a night awake, it was his job to make sure residents were safe at night, that things were turned off, and that everyone was where they were supposed to be.
You know, go through, make sure everything's turned off, everything's safe. You count noses or toeses. And now
he's the evening shift leader. A job that began as simply a way to make some money turned into a calling.
What I saw here was a lot of caring people helping others find their way. What made Bill Brady click so well is mutual respect for each other among staff and among the clients that came through, because it didn't matter what your background was. They took you at face value and let you shine, you know.
House calls Charlie Bean on the phone, a longtime employee whose friends call him Carlos, and we find out where he is and head back down the street to the healing house.
Carlos?
Hey.
Okay.
Bean is in the basement, where he used to lead clients through art projects. Bean started working at Search in 2001 and at Bill Brady in 2005. He says he's definitely had disagreements with the institution. For example, he laments rules and regulations that he says distract from the day-to-day hands-on work he does with clients. And he mentions spending increasing amounts of time doing paperwork. But he also says this is one of the best jobs he's ever had, and this team is close.
I've never experienced anything like it. I mean, I've had close friendships and stuff, but not a group of people like this that, you know, you come in and you jump on shift and somebody's going out the door and you know you've got their back and they know you've got their back, and it's just this, I want to say, seamless kind of flow that goes on between the people. So that's been special.
Of the three employees I spoke with, Roberta Kitka has the longest tenure. She started here as an intern in 1998.
I wanted to help people because I'm in recovery myself, and stuck my toe in the door of doing my internship.
Eventually, she put in for a full-time job.
Showed up for an interview and said, I'm here to put my clinket 2 cents in.
Most recently, she's been in a supervisory role. Kitka says she likes watching the transformation in clients between their first day and the time they graduate.
We more or less serve the people who are throwaway people, people that end up making something of themselves. We've had women call us up, I have my kids back. I've only got 30 credits left and I'll finish my college degree. Things like that. And they're not throwaway people. And that's the way we look at it.
Now that Kitka is done working at Bill Brady, she's moving to Anchorage. Her daughter is up there, and so is Dina Akoi, a treatment center for women and children where Kitka did her first internship.
And the two ladies I did it with, worked with, are still there. So I'm going to pop my head in and say, hi, I'm back.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. Every day, people all over Alaska are discovering that public transportation can benefit their businesses and their communities. Public transportation in Alaska provides 7 million rides a year to work, medical appointments, shopping, school, and social opportunities. There's more information at alaskamobility.org. This message sponsored by the nonprofit organizations Alaska Mobility Coalition and the American Public Transportation Association.
Ketchikan, Kotzebue,
Dillingham, Sitka, Chugiak,
Fairbanks, Fort Yukon, Wrangell,
Barrow, Unalaska, Dutch Harbor, Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Annie Feit. This week on AK, bacon. From its sound to its smell, it's safe to say most meat eaters love everything about bacon. But few love it as much as Eric Johnson. He makes his homemade. Over the years, he's experimented with different bacon recipes, once even using an entire bottle of whiskey as a marinade. But as APRN's Dave Waldron found out, it pays to keep it simple with something so good.
And I just do my best to cut it in half.
In his Peters Creek home, Eric Johnson is prepping a massive amount of pork to make some of his signature bacon. This man is no stranger to meat.
Growing up, my grandparents who lived in North Dakota made Polish sausage every year. And so from the time I was about 6 years old, I was pretty comfortable making different meat products.
Johnson made plenty of sausage and jerky growing up, but it wasn't until recently that he decided to take on bacon. It took some trial and error, but Johnson says he's managed to find the right spices and cuts for a few solid bacon recipes. Right now, he's working with two massive pork shoulders, which he says will take about 8 days to turn into delicious bacon.
And this one's a boneless shoulder that, like I said, I got from Costco.
Do you break even, or do you save a lot of money making this homemade bacon?
That's a good question. I bought two packages of pork shoulder, so a total of about 30 pounds of bacon, and it's going to cost me about $60, maybe $70 when you include the salt and the sugar. So all said and done, that's pretty cheap bacon. That's $2.50 or $3 a pound tops.
Johnson carefully weighs out the spices for his maple and brown sugar rub, while his dog Rhubarb stares longingly and licks her lips.
Rhubarb is a bacon and anything else that falls on the floor dog.
The recipe is simple. One part brown sugar, one part salt, and one part maple syrup.
I get the real stuff. I don't get any of the sketchy breakfast syrup that has heaven knows what in it.
After the mixture is finished, Johnson puts each shoulder in a gallon-sized Ziploc bag. He massages the ingredients in with force, almost like he's kneading bread dough. Can it take a beating pretty well? You're not going to pulverize it?
No, if anything, only more tender.
Next, the meat sits in the fridge sealed for 1 week.
Now this time tomorrow, there'll already be a fair bit of liquid in the bag. And every day I'll just make it a point, when I'm rummaging through the fridge for a snack or something, to flip the bag over once to make sure that the cure and liquid solution ends up being evenly distributed on the meat.
After that comes the interesting part. The meat is taken out of its bag and left uncovered in the fridge for a whole day.
And what that does is it creates a pellet, what's called a pellicle, on the meat. And it's a shiny, almost sticky layer of proteins that form on the meat when it's left in the exposed air. And that pellicle is what's actually going to absorb the smoke flavor.
Johnson says the smoking process can either be done in a smoker or in a standard grill on low heat with wood chips. But neither of us are patient enough to wait a week, so Johnson tosses a couple of already finished bacon strips on the skillet. This doesn't look like your typical store-bought bacon. Johnson says that's because he doesn't use nitrites, a preservative commonly used to prevent bacteria from gathering in the meat. He says this practice isn't for everybody, but for him, it's a risk he's willing to take.
It's largely up to you whether you decide to use nitrites or not, realizing that if you choose not to, food handling and food safety is of paramount importance to make sure that you don't end up with any sort of nasty foodborne infection. This cottage bacon will taste somewhere in between bacon, ham, and pork chops. And it'll cook white, just like a regular piece of pork would.
All right, enough talk. It's time to see if this bacon tastes as good as it smells.
Well, wow, that's really good.
Yum.
The bacon is thick, smoky, and has a nice sweet finish to it. And while Johnson is pleased with the recipe, like a true bacon enthusiast, he's already thinking of ways to improve it. Right now, he's got his sights set on some birch trees that he'll be tapping this year.
And if all goes well, it's possible that next year I'll be making, instead of maple and brown sugar bacon, birch syrup and brown sugar bacon. That would be the pinnacle of achievement for me.
And when that time does come, I really should be there to eat, report that achievement. For AK, I'm Dave Waldron.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to the village of Newtok on the Ninglick River, which drains into the Bering Sea. The community is being relocated because of coastal erosion due to climate change.
Stanley Tom, and I'm from Newtok, Alaska. It's a small village, population of 370. still living remotely, and we still speak our language in Yupik and still doing a subsistence lifestyle. They like to go out herring fishing for subsistence, and also salmon fishing, and do commercial fishing with halibut. And it's like all summer long fishing for winter preparation. Due to permafrost melting and eroding of the Ningal River, we are relocating our village to Mahtarvik site. And we've been discussing this relocation more than 30 years. It's a never-ending process. Eskimo dance. What we do is we invite our neighboring villages like Tanunuk, Tuksuk, Knight, Metaphornik, Chivak, Cooper, and we invite them every year. And in return, they also invite us too. Berry picking, seal hunting, all kinds. That's how they make songs. Some gifts like anything, a house, utensils, or anything. It's like blackfish or lustfish, whitefish, all sorts of stuff to the visitors, too.
Stanley Tom is tribal administrator in Nutok. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Dave Waldron and Alex Duer. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Annie Fett.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Stephanie Joyce in Unalaska, Shady Grove Oliver in Wrangell, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Kristen Spack is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Children need at least 60 minutes of physical activity each day for good health. So to help your children hit that mark, find fun ways to add more activity to their day. Go for a walk together. Sign up for events in your community. Make time to be physically active as a family. Get out and play with your kids every day. For activity ideas and tips on raising healthy kids in Alaska, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The School of Management at the University of Alaska Southeast has degrees online to prepare students for leadership in business industries across Alaska. Information at uas.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by University of Alaska Southeast. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health, and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.